So, I already mentioned to you a little bit earlier that earlier this week I went to give a talk at Curtin University on human rights and Buddhism. I usually go every year there. I've been going there for a long time. And to give that little talk, it would be nice actually to mention a few things which I presented there on the human rights aspect of Buddhism. And I think many of you know that many people really, really defend the freedom of religion. And I was really putting out, we should also remember that part of human rights is the freedom from religion. Because, you know, religion has caused a lot of problems in our world. And just because you're a religion doesn't mean that you have all these rights to do whatever you want, whenever you want. And even, you know, sometimes people ask me, you know, well, you know, really, is Buddhism a religion anyway? And the standard answer is yes, Buddhism is a religion for tax purposes only. We've got to be proud, we've got to pay our bills. So that sometimes the place of religion, sometimes that religion becomes an obstacle to really what religion should be doing, that sense of freedom, social cohesion, harmony, peace, the ability for people to pursue their happiness and joy without offending or imposing theirs on others. And that's something which I always liked about Buddhism. It was not in the religion in the sense of always imposing on other people. Even though, if ever you go down to our retreat centre, especially on the occasion on Sunday for our Katina ceremony, we're holding in the retreat centre there, you see the sign on the gate to the left. And you see on the bottom of that sign, it says, trespassers will be converted. Which is much better than saying they'll be prosecuted, because people don't believe that. People will go in and cause all sorts of havoc. But you put a sign on there saying trespassers will be converted, and that really scares off a lot of people. And you know that recently someone came to visit and they took a photo of that sign, and when they returned to London, they noticed in the Daily Telegraph, which is a very prominent newspaper in UK, there was a section there on funny signs. So they sent up that sign and it won Sign of the Week. So the sign at Jhana Grove is actually famous throughout UK. It was featured in the Daily Telegraph magazine. That's how famous our Buddhist Society of West Australia is, especially in terms of funny signs. But, you know, about converting, look, somebody asked me today at the retreat centre, said they were a Christian, but they love Buddhist meditation. And of course some people have that sense of conflict, she said. You know, I don't know whether I'm a Buddhist, whether I'm a Christian, and what should I do? Does it really matter? I said, no, it's your human right not to worry about those things. You can take the best of each. In other words, whatever you like the most, you can call yourself a Buddhist on Friday evening, and you can call yourself a Jew on Saturday and a Christian on Sunday. That way you can follow three holidays every year instead of just one. But no, sometimes why people say Buddhism is not a religion is because, you know, what actually is this Buddhism business? Now, I've got to really apologize to some people because, you know, I've been given so many talks the last 7 days, I forget what I said last week. So did I say the story last week of the container and the contents? No, I don't think so. Okay, great. Phew. I didn't think I did, but, you know, I'm getting old now and sometimes you do forget things. Just like that person who went to the doctors and he's, you know, actually the doctor so said you've got two very, very, very serious illnesses. So the first one is cancer. Very, very bad, probably terminal. And the fellow thought, my goodness, that's terrible. What's my second disease? The second disease, you've got Alzheimer's, dementia. And the fellow said, well, at least I haven't got cancer. I know I've told that joke before, but I hope many of you forgot it, because you may have Alzheimer's as well. But anyway, that particular story is one of my favourite stories, because you know, it starts off as a little bit of a joke. Like, many of the reasons I tell funny stories is because it actually gets deep into some interesting parts of human nature, in this particular case on religious nature and the rights of religions and the rights from religion, and why there is sometimes problems there. And that was a story many, many years ago, or maybe not that many years ago, was it 10 years ago or whatever? You know, after George Bush, the first George Bush, started Guantanamo Bay, and many people were accused of all sorts of acts, were imprisoned there. And one day, apparently, according to the newspapers, a soldier there took a copy of the Buddhist, Holy Quran, and flushed it down the toilet in front of one of the Muslim prisoners. And of course there was a riot throughout the world. I think you may remember that, the flushing of the Quran down the toilet incident. And a couple of days later, a reporter from our local paper, the West Australian, called me. He said he was doing an article about that incident, and he was focusing on all the religious leaders in Perth. He'd already called up the two archbishops, the Anglican and the Catholic, and the moderator of the Uniting Church, and the rabbi. Now he got to me, the Buddhist. So he said, I'm asking everybody the same question, so I want the answer from the perspective of a Buddhist. Ajahn Brahm, as a Buddhist leader in Perth, what would you do? What would be your reaction if someone took a Buddhist holy book and flushed it down your toilet? Without any hesitation, I said, sir, if somebody flushed a Buddhist holy book down my toilet, I'd call a plumber straight away. And that's what I said. You know, that reporter said, that's the first sensible answer I've got all day. I don't know why no one else thinks of those one-liners, but it was true. But anyhow, then when he finished laughing, I got serious. And I said, sir, you can flush as many Buddhist holy books as you like down my toilet. You can blow up Buddhist temples and churches and monasteries. You can kill as many Buddhist monks and destroy as many Buddhist statues as you ever want. But I will never, ever allow you to flush Buddhism down the toilet or destroy peace, forgiveness, kindness. That I will never allow you to destroy. And I made this wonderful distinction from that little interchange of the container and the contents. The books, they're containers. Does anyone ever read what's inside? And what it actually says to forgive, you know, not to go to war, not to kill people, not to be cruel to people. The Buddha statue behind me, what's it symbolizing? It's symbolizing peace and compassion. That's what it's there for, to teach people to live in peace and harmony together. And so if you blow up a Buddha statue and you kill other people as a result of it, you haven't really understood what that was containing, what its message was. And all these temples and all these monks and nuns, if you kill somebody else because someone killed me, you haven't been paying any attention at all in all the time I've been giving talks. What is a container? What do the monks actually talk about? You know, the Buddhist nun, what does she represent? What are these temples, these retreat centers, what are they there for? What is it? It's a contents. And when you don't mistake the container for the contents, it means that all this violence caused by religion has got no purpose anymore. The outer forms, whether it's wearing a hijab or wearing a robe, is not important. It's what's underneath that robe. Why you wear it? What's contained in that message? In the books, in the churches, in the temples, whatever. What's its purpose? It's one of the reasons why if ever you come to visit our monks' monastery, down at Bodhinyana, or our retreat centre, or our nuns' monastery, you'll always find it's very, very simple. Practical, but you never see any sort of ornate marble or chandeliers or paintings of grandmasters on the ceiling, just like in the Vatican. No, have a look up there. That ceiling actually needs a bit of a repaint. Maybe we could find the local Michelangelo and put a mural on it. No, because that's not the purpose of a Buddhist temple. The message is always simplicity. Which is why if you go down to our monastery, we try and keep it as simple, as free as possible, because that's the content of that message. Keep it simple. And if ever you go to our main meditation hall in Bodhinyana Monastery, for years people have been trying to put more things in there. They put another vase of flowers, and I take it out and give it somewhere else. They put another nick there. They want to put a portrait on the wall. They want to do things. I keep taking them off. Why is it when people see an empty space, they want to fill it? If you've got an empty space in your house, do you go to IKEA and think, now what can we put in that corner over there? Why do people not like space, simplicity? Because we've forgotten the contents and all we see is the containers. What is a house for anyway? Is it for just impressing your friends when you come around? Look, if you really want to impress your friends, have nothing in the house. That really, they remember that. Just like if any of you do come to our katina at Bodhinyana Monastery, one of, and the nuns' monastery as well, I hope, but I'm not quite sure how they run these things. One of the events we do over there, one of the great reasons for going, we have these guided tours of the monastery. So you can go inside the monks' huts, see where I live, look under the bed to see if there's any copies of Playboy underneath it. Not Playboy, I'm sorry, I meant Play Monk. No, we don't have Play Monk or anything like that. Actually to see how we live. So one of the places, if you go down, you'll see is Ajahn Brahm's cave. I actually live in a cave. You know, the monks, they knew I liked caves, so they built one for me. I mean, you know, it's just a monk-made cave, not a man-made cave, you know, of rocks and covered with the concrete and earth, and it's beautiful in there. And it's very, very simple. And people go in there, is that where you really live? Yes. So I sleep at night. This evening I have to leave here and go back there. That's where I go and sleep. That's where I meditate. And it's beautiful. It's so simple. There's nothing there. And many of you have been inside it. And that's how we live, because the container is the cave, but the content is simplicity, peace, emptiness, freedom. And that's what it's there for. So when you come into a Buddhist temple, it's the simplicity which is reminding you of. To live a simple life means living a free life. You don't need so many things to live a free life. I was living in another hut. You can see the other monks' huts as well. They're simple rooms. And one day we had some visitors. It was one of these housewives groups, you know, who had, you know, formed a little club. I forget what they were called. And they would just go to see interesting places or weird people. And I think we counted as the second type. So they came to see these weird monks, you know, nice afternoon. And so I took them around. And I always remember taking them into my hut at the time. It was about, what was it, 3 meters by 2.4. There's enough there to lie down and go to sleep and meditate. You don't need a big room. I remember this woman, she went inside and said, this is it? Is this where you live? I said, yeah, you know, you can see it. You know, this is the bed where I sleep, or the, you know, the mats where I sleep on. This is my water bottle. This is my alarm clock. You know, this is my flashlight. Is that all you've got? I said, yes. And I always remember her comment. She turned around to a friend and said, wow, if this was my home, I'd get all my housework done in half an hour. And I really felt for her, as I feel for you. You know, how big is your house? And after the monks have been, like I went to your house this morning, how long does it take to clean up? Took a long time, didn't it? I went to her house this morning for lunch. Now, if you come to my house for lunch, my cave, it'd take me 5 minutes to clean up. So, you see the benefits of simplicity? Why is it that people have so many things? You're crazy. So, it's the container. It's not important. The contents are. And the contents of the Buddha statue is peace, simplicity, kindness. Now, if that was one's religion, yes, that has full rights, because you see that is enshrined in things like the Declaration of Human Rights, the sense of freedom and peace in our world. So it should be good that we should have this freedom from religion where, you know, we have our different containers and we think that that's all that they see, just the containers. If we go to the contents, what's actually inside? Now that's where we can have a lot of peace and harmony. That's why that, you know, when I was away, actually not really away, but you know, teaching the monks down at Serpentine during the last 3 months, and the nuns were up there teaching each other up at Gijiganup, we had all sorts of visitors come here to give talks. And I love it when you get all sorts of different people, Muslims, Christians, you have good old Giz Watson, a good friend, gay, lesbian, green, really, and she's a Buddhist as well. At least she's told me she was anyway. Which is brilliant. So you get all these different people coming in. And why on earth do we encourage this in this Buddhist centre? Because if we allow too many Christians in here, they'll convert you all and you won't come back again. We lose our members. And I think I'm trying to do that, actually, because the less members I have, the more time I can have a rest on a Friday night. I won't have to come up here. That's the job of a teacher, you know. The job of a teacher is to try and get rid of disciples. It's true. We want to get you enlightened, so you know everything, you know more than I know, so you don't have to come back here again and I can retire and have an easy life. So my job is to try and get rid of you. That's why I'm a very, very, very bad teacher. You keep coming back again every year. If I was a school teacher, if I was teaching in school and the class kept coming back year after year after year, what sort of teacher would I be? I must be terrible. But no, the purpose, you know, of coming here is also to feel the contents of this place, the peace, the freedom, the love, the kindness. And that's why just, you know, this place, it may have a ceiling which needs painting. It may have, you know, we're doing some work on the gardens. It may need a garden which needs sort of cleaning or whatever. But quite frankly, I've told my committee this. It's important we keep it nice and tidy, but the most important thing of this place is the people. The centre is not the buildings, it's you. You're the centre, you're the church, you're the place, you're the important thing. Because people are always more important than things. And they're certainly more important than buildings. Once, this is a story from the ancient Buddhist texts. There was a monk, and I think it was called Dhammarama, and he was staying in a monastery with one of the Buddha's chief disciples, Mahakotita, who was a fully enlightened arahat. And this monk, he was so diligent, he would get up early in the morning and sweep the monastery, and at lunchtime and in the evening, he was sweeping, sweeping, sweeping. And the monk said, "Look, you didn't become a monk just to keep monasteries clean. That's not the purpose. The purpose is doing some meditation, understanding the meaning of life, becoming enlightened." So he said, "Yeah, you can sweep in the morning and maybe in the evening, but in the middle of the day you do some more meditation, okay?" And of course, after a short time, that monk also became enlightened. From that time on, the monastery was never that clean. We had one more enlightened being in the world. And that was really important. Even though this temple might not be so clean, if we have one happier, more peaceful person, then this temple has done its job. People are more important than things. So we will always have tacky temples as Buddhists. They will be all over the place. But hopefully we have happy, peaceful, kind people. Look, some years ago, as I was giving a talk here, somebody just over there in about that space over there, they leant out, they laid down and fell asleep and started snoring right in the middle of my talk. And someone woke them up. You're being disrespectful. You shouldn't be snoring in the middle of a talk. You shouldn't even be sleeping. And when I found out who did that, I told them off. Not the person who'd lay down and snored, but the person who woke them up. Because that was a woman who was being domestically abused at home. Now, if any of you have ever been in that desperate situation, everyone says, well, go and see a policeman, go and see a counsellor. But at the time you're in that situation, you can't think straight. Your mind is confused. The path is not clear to you. And so sometimes, you know, it takes you a while to do what, you know, you think you should do. Never judge a person if they don't act in such a situation. They don't know what to do. But what she did do was come here. When she came here, she felt that this place was safe, peaceful and kind. She told me that this was the only place she could get some sleep. The only place she felt safe and protected enough to relax and catch up on her sleep. And I thought, wonderful. You can come here any time and sleep. That's what this place is here for. Not to just listen to a talk. That's the container, the contents, the kindness. So I mentioned that story. So if anyone misbehaves here, please be kind. Because that's the purpose, that's what we're talking about. The container is not important. The contents really are. Understanding that, you can understand in one of my other lovely stories. This is, I told this last year, but again, I hope you've forgotten it. In another temple, some time ago, the head monk was woken up early in the morning. I mean, really, because for us, we get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I remember, you know, ordering a tradesperson to come and work in my monastery, and he said, I'm coming first thing in the morning. And I said, great. And I'll see you first thing in the morning, 4 o'clock. And he said, that's not what I meant by first thing in the morning. That's me first thing in the morning. So we got up very early. But in this abbot, he got up at 2 o'clock because he was disturbed. He heard a sound in the shrine room. First of all, he thought, maybe it's one of my monks getting up early. But then he thought, no, not my monks. They don't get up early. So he had to get up. When he went up into the main hall, he saw what was making the noise. It was a burglar. And he was trying to open the donation box. And as soon as a burglar saw the monk, he got out a knife. Keep away! Don't come near! And the monk said, can I help you? Shut up! Said the burglar. You know, I always like telling this story. One of the reasons why is because as a monk, I'm not allowed to, you know, to shout and say shut up and to sort of act angrily. But now I can let it all go. All that repressed anger, I can play the role of this really bad burglar. And as soon as the monk realized he was opening the donation box, the monk reached into his pocket. What are you doing? Stay still. And the monk took out a bunch of keys. Here are the keys. Help yourself. Is this a trick, punk? No, I'm not really good at this, but I really am trying, okay? I'm sure that no one says that these days. And the monk handed over the keys. And the thief was pointing the knife at this monk and opening the donation box at the same time. And having opened the box, he started emptying the contents, all these notes, into his pocket. And the monk looked at him and said to him, "When was the last time you had something to eat?"
"None of your business! Shut up!"
That was quite a good one, I think. And the monk said, "In the cupboard just above the donation box, you'll find some food left over from this morning. Help yourself." And that man was very hungry. So having filled his pockets with cash, he filled the remaining spaces with food.
"And don't call the police,"
said the thief as he walked away. "Why should I call the police?" said the monk. "I've given you that money. It's charity. Kind people give it to us. Can't we give it to you? And take the food. We have plenty here. All monks are fat." And so the thief ran away with all the contents of the donation box and lots of food as well. And the following morning, he had to tell his committee — Dennis is our president here — had to tell the committee what happened, because all the money had gone. You had to audit it. But you know, the committee were wise enough to know what a wonderful thing that is. You know, we're supposed to teach non-attachment, kindness and generosity. Can't a monk be kind and generous too? And he said, "Well, even though we lost some money, it was a beautiful act. So well done." So they thanked that monk. And a few days later, the monk read the newspaper and saw that burglar had been captured while he robbed another house. And because he was a bad burglar and done many, many thefts, he was sentenced to 6 years in jail. Just over 6 years later, the same monk woke up early in the morning, just about 2 o'clock. He went to investigate, and what do you think he saw? The burglar was back. "Do you remember me?" said the burglar. "I was released yesterday." And the monk looked at him, he recognized him. He reached into his pocket. "Okay, here are the keys, help yourself." And the burglar said, "Put your keys away. I don't want the money." And the burglar said, "For the last 6 years, in my prison cell, I've been thinking about you every day. You are the only person who's ever been kind to me in my whole life. You actually cared about me, saw I was thin and gave me some food and let me have the money and let me go. I never met a person like you before. I've been thinking that when I came last time, I realized I stole the wrong thing. I stole money and food. I've come back again. I've come back again to steal. But this time, I want to steal the secret of your kindness. Please teach me how to be generous like that, and how to be kind when someone's pointing a knife at you. Please make me a monk." Isn't that a nice story? Because what is that money for? Money is a content, container. What is the content? What do you have this money for? What do you have a house for? What do you have a temple for? What's the purpose of this? Isn't it to make more kindness and peace in this world? So when we understand what the contents are, the contents of life, not the containers, what the purpose of these things are, we can find a more beautiful thing. What do you really want in the world? Not containers, but the contents. Don't you really want to be respected? Does someone understand? Yes, you're not the best, but you are good enough. To have your ideas and views respected. They may not be correct. They may not win the day, but at least they're respected. We have this last year 21 monks at Bodhinyana Monastery. So every time there's a decision to be made, we have to have a meeting. You know, the oldest democracy in the world is not from Greece, it was from India. Look at the books, the evidence is very strong. Democracy started at the same time in Greece and in India, and it looks like India beat it, Greece, by quite a few years. And 2,500 years ago, when Buddhism started, the Buddha adopted a democratic form of government for the communities of monks. And that democratic system has lasted unchanged for 25 centuries. So our monasteries run on a democratic system where every monk has the same vote. Even though I'm the boss, I've been in that monastery for 28 years and built many of those buildings with my own hands, still, a monk who comes today has exactly the same vote as I have. And the only way we get things done is that everybody say what they want to say with respect. Even if they say a stupid idea, you have the right to say it, and it will be respected and considered, and see if we can have some consensus eventually. You know how consensus works? You don't have to push and force your idea. Because when you push and force your ideas, you get big egos. You know, just like Tony Abbott, Julia Gillard. They've got such big egos, it can be never, ever any compromise or solutions there. So instead of having the big egos, is what happens when you start to argue. If the matter cannot be resolved, we let it go, we leave it alone. Unless there's unanimity and all the monks agree, we cannot move forward. So we stop for a while. Give time, consider. The thing about a monastery is we can take time. It doesn't matter if we get it done today, we'll get it done next week, or next year, or next lifetime. It's great being a Buddhist, you know, we can actually be patient. You know, some of these Christians, they think they've only got one life, they're so impatient, they want to get to heaven right now. It doesn't matter if you don't make it this lifetime, you've got another lifetime and the one after that. Come take it easy. Don't rush around so much. So it's that beautiful sort of gentle, taking it cool, you know, it will happen sooner or later. Just like when you come, if you do come to any of our ceremonies on the weekend, you know, Bodhinyana, say on Sunday, and the week after that, that's good. No, that was Saturday, was it? The week after at Nuns Monastery. Following Sunday at the Nuns Monastery. If you come to any of our meetings, any of our ceremonies there, it's absolute chaos. There's a few people here who really work hard trying to organise you all, but it doesn't work. But in monasteries in Sri Lanka, it's the same in Thailand, it's the same in Burma, and we like to actually get that culture here in Australia too. In other words, totally disorganised, but it works. Somehow or other, things get done. And I really like that because I hated organised religion when I was young. This is disorganised religion, Buddhism. But somehow or other, it works. You know why? Because people are more important than things. Have people being happy is more important than ordering people with cattle prods to stand in line. In other words, kindness is the order of the day. The contents, why you're there. So if you come to our monastery and you have a happy, kind day, it's a successful ceremony. So we never actually do fundraising. We do fundraising. We take the D off and make that the most important part of the day. Because isn't that what you really want? You know, you want to be respected. You want your views to be heard. And as long as views are heard, usually you can get by. And look, there is advantage of being the senior monk. Because even though it's a democracy, you know, if you're really smart and wise, you know, you can work the system. And I know how to get my own way. And I've told this before to you, but you know, it really works. How to get your own way in a marriage, how to get your own way in a monastery or in a committee, Dennis, and how to get your own way even in your business. Years ago, I was number two monk. We had another monk who was senior to me. Very wonderful monk, but you know, he left some time ago. And I remember this occasion that I was the main builder. I was building that place. And one day I was walking with him. We needed a new hut for the monks. And I said to him, you know, I've got an idea. I think we should build a hut on the hill right over there. And he said, no, stupid idea. It's ridiculous. It won't work. I was wise enough to know Buddhist psychology. I shut up. I never argued. I say, okay. Now remember, never argue with your husband. It doesn't work. Same with your wife or your boss. I let it go for 2 weeks. Because by that time, he'd forget. Then I'd bring it up again. I'd be walking with him and said, I think we should build a hut on the hill over there. And he'd say, stupid idea, ridiculous, it won't work. And I'd drop it again for another 2 weeks, because what I was doing, I knew I was putting the seed into his brain. Because when you say something, it actually gets in there. It's amazing, some of the jokes which I've told, some of the way I speak, I've seen these other monks saying exactly just the same as me, like clones. I've seen you guys saying the same as well. And I went to the marriage ceremony last week, and you know, they were saying last week here on Saturday, a couple of the youth group here were getting married, and they said in their pledges, I think something about, from now on it's not about me, about you, it's all about us. I don't know where that came from. That was my invention. You stole it. No, it's okay. But, you know, when those come up, you see just how this conditioning works, how psychology works. So I said to this monk, okay, doesn't matter. I forgot it. I dropped it because I knew the cogs were in motion. And it only took another couple of weeks, that's all. And this happened time and time again. I'd be walking with him in the monastery, and he'd suddenly stop and say, I've just had an idea. You know, I think we should build a hut on the hill over there. And I'd say, wow, that's a really good idea of yours. Let's do it. And it works every time. You know, you tell your husband, look, I really need a new pair of shoes. You've got a whole shoe shop in your cupboard. What do you need a new pair of shoes for? Well, that's right, darling. Shut up, don't argue, otherwise you'll spoil it. 2 weeks later, tell him, once you thought he's forgotten, darling, I think I should get a new pair of shoes. No, you're just like Imelda Marcos, you are, just with all your shoes. You've only got 2 feet anyway, how many shoes do you need? Drop it. Because once the seed's inside his mind, it's got in his subconscious, it will actually work and work and work without him realizing it. That's the thing. He mustn't realizing that he's being controlled by you. And then, it's the way it works every time. Then one day he said, darling, you know, I really think you need a new pair of shoes. And don't tell him I told you so. That was spoiling the whole thing. You'd never be able to use it again. The thing to say said, wow, that's so kind of you. You're just so sensitive. Oh, I'm a good husband. Because what you're doing there is you're acknowledging that we all have to have our own ideas. So you're giving people that option. I don't care. I don't care that, you know, the other monk thought he made those decisions. I know where those decisions made from. They came from me without him realizing it. That's how you get power over others. So that way you can have a democracy, you know, but sort of in a beautiful way. And you don't have to have arguments. Because, you know, if an idea is good, if it really is good, the other person will see it. And if it's not good, then that thing doesn't work. So it's not a good idea to begin with. So you put it out there, it works its way through the brains, and then it comes out again afterwards, and that's the way it works. So we want that respect. We want to have some peace and harmony in our life. We want kindness. So that's actually what religion should be doing. So when I gave the talk my goodness, there's so much more to talk about human rights. One of the other things I was talking about, which really came up, was the idea of justice. Because we were talking about, there was a fellow there who was from Colombia, and he was talking about the drug gangs and also the government-sponsored military, apparently, who were doing so many extrajudicial killings, many people disappearing in the middle of the night. And he said some of these gangs would play, and he told me, he said he saw it playing football with the people's heads. Gross stuff. And he said, what should you do? What would be the Buddhist response to that? Should we try and round those people up and punish them? And it's something which I've known from my own psychology and from Buddhism. This idea of justice, which forms part of human rights ideas, is totally distorted. You have to make the big distinction between justice and revenge. Do you want revenge, or do you really want justice? And then what do you mean by justice? For me, what justice means is acknowledging that a fault had been committed. To have the truth come out. That's an important part of justice. Open trials so we know what was done. And then, not punishment, but rehabilitation. Solving the problem, moving forward, never moving backwards. Because it's the punishment bit which I don't agree with, simply because it does not work. Number one, if there's a fear of punishment, who wants to acknowledge they've done something wrong? If you knew you were going to get punished by your partner by admitting what you got up to on the weekend when they were away, would you tell them? The fear of punishment is a reason for lies. Why we can't be truthful to one another. Why kids can't tell their parents the problems they're going through in their life. They fear that mum and dad will hit them or shout at them, take away their privilege. The fear of punishment is a reason for the lack of truth in our society. And that's especially true in your families. Please, if you have kids, tell them. You can tell mummy or daddy anything. As long as you're telling the truth, we won't punish you, no matter what it is. If you say you've been taking drugs, alcohol, stealing or whatever, I don't care what it is you've done, if you tell me the truth, there'll be no punishment at all. Because mum and dad are here to help. And they can't start any help until people tell you what they're really doing. And if you're in a marriage or a partnership, can you take that partnership to that level where your partner can tell you anything? You know, you may be hurt by what they said, but you won't punish them by scolding them or shouting at them. Because the position I'm in, as a religious leader or leader of this community, many times people have come up, husband has been caught philandering, sleeping with another woman while they're still married. Or the other way around too. The wife has got a boyfriend. What's going to happen next? So first of all, wouldn't it be wonderful if when they first had that urge, they felt comfortable enough to come up and tell you, look, there's this girl in the office and I feel really, really excited by her. Or even, there's this boy and I've slept with him. If you can actually admit that, because you feel that your partner will realize you're not perfect, because no one is perfect, and you realize your partner will understand that they're coming to tell you not because they want punishment or want to end the relationship. They're saying, look, I need your help. I made a big mistake. Hands up, anyone here has never made a big mistake in their life. That's a big mistake. Okay, maybe 3 or 4 did, but most of you have. Okay, now maybe your big mistake is coming next. Sooner or later, we all make big mistakes. When you do make those big mistakes, like most people do, like, what you really want to do, look, please, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do it, and I was stupid, I made a big mistake, I don't know why I did that. But you can't tell the people you love the most, because you're afraid. And what happens next? You hide, hide, hide. It gets worse by the time it is found out. Relationship is really, really difficult to mend. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could actually tell each other? Because what you'd be doing, you're coming up to your partner and say, look, I did this awful thing. I feel so terrible about it. Please forgive me. Because with that honesty, we actually know the ground. We know what's gone on. There's no hiding anymore. And from that truth, there's all sorts of ways forward. Punishment just makes it worse. Acknowledgement and forgiveness means, okay, make sure we never do that again. You know, move jobs, change the telephone number and email address so that person can't contact you again. Whatever it is, and I've had many, many, many cases of people who have had their marriages, their relationships really on the rocks because of, you know, misconduct, hanky-panky, adultery, whatever you wish to call it, but got themselves together again and had a wonderful relationship together. That terrible act hurt them so much has actually bound them together in a relationship which does go to the next level. They will never do that again. But when that husband has got forgiveness, wow, that's such a great woman that she's managed to forgive me for that. I will never, ever do that again. Look, when I often talk about my father, because his story, he was abused as a kid by his father, my paternal grandfather I never met. But as a result of his violent domestic abuse on the hands of his dad, instead of acting the abuse on me, he did totally the opposite. He used the abuse he had experienced to learn, to grow, and become a beautiful being, a wonderful father. He would never, ever abuse me, could never hit me at all. Sometimes that's what happens. You can't do that if you know what it's like. Same with a person who's been forgiven. So what happened once, I was with one of my best friends coming home from school. This was in the late 60s. It was actually a very good school. But, you know, I got there through scholarships because my family was very poor. My best friend, he'd been busted for taking marijuana. And he said his whole life was destroyed. His parents were so upset. At that time, my father was very sick. He was going to die a year later, 6 months. And I thought, if ever I took a drug and my father found out, it would kill him. And he was so weak anyway with his sickness. Just disappointing him that much, I just couldn't do it. And that's actually what stopped me. Sort of what other people did in that time, in the 60s, taking drugs, I just couldn't do it. Couldn't harm somebody who trusted me so much. That's what happens. If you have a relationship with someone and you can tell them anything, you just don't want to hurt them. You can't. It's just impossible to. He also once told me, he said, son, when I was about 11 or 12, don't ever steal. Because if you want something that much, you're willing to risk getting caught stealing. If you want something that much, just tell me and I'll get it for you straight away, no questions asked. And he was so poor, he couldn't afford it. But I knew if I wanted, say, that bicycle, and I was willing to steal it, that man would just work his butt off to get that money so I can have a bike. If I wanted it that much, I was willing to steal it. Somebody that sort of honest, open, you know, If you are that honest with your partner, they will never abuse you. Maybe once, never ever again. You can't waste such a person who's forgiven you that much. That's why some of those relationships, justice of punishment, it just does not work. And don't punish other people if they let you down. Please forgive them. Come together and find out ways of moving together in the future so it never ever happens again. Our so-called justice system, the prisons, always getting more and more people in those jails, coming out and doing the same thing again and again and again. Look, is that the sort of society you want to live in? So, underlying human rights, justice, please take away the punishment and instead have some sort of rehabilitation. Maybe it was also because when I was a student, I read this book by Samuel Butler. It's over 100 years ago he wrote this book. But it was a satire. A satire is where you transpose ideas to make it really clear just that something is terribly wrong. And in his satire, the book was called Erewhon, which is the word nowhere spelt backwards. He wrote this fiction about finding this society which has evolved parallel to Western society but in a total different ethos. There, if you committed a crime, like burglary or theft, you were sent to see the doctor. What we take as crime was considered to be a sickness which had to be healed by psychologists, counsellors, whatever, but no punishment at all. However, if you got sick, that's your fault. You are responsible for your health. So if you get sick, you go to jail. It's true, isn't it? If you have a cardiac arrest, it's your fault. You haven't been exercising, stressing out at work, eating the wrong foods, and you cause a lot of problems for our society. Anyone who has a cardiac arrest, they take up so much of taxpayers' money, they should go to jail. There's a logical argument to that, isn't there? And especially, I remember this one scene where this fellow visited a courtroom and there was a trial going on. And the man was in the dock sniffling with a cold. That was his crime. He caught a cold. And the judge said, "It's quite obvious you've got a cold. So you're guilty. And according to your records, this is not the first time you've appeared before me. I told you last time to eat more vegetables, look after your health, and you haven't. Now look, you've got a cold, you're contagious. You're spreading this disease to so many more people, that's even worse. So I'm going to send you to 10 years in solitary so you don't spread this cold to anyone else. And I'll teach you a lesson. To exercise, eat good food, so you don't get colds in the future." You can see there's a certain logic in it. Why is it when you get sick, it's always rehabilitative, always caring for you, even though that you take some responsibility that the fact you're sick. But when it's a so-called crime, it's always punishment, no rehabilitation. So maybe it's the hospitals should be for the criminals and the prisons should be for the people with recurring sicknesses. Is that fair? Can you see the point there? The justice system where punishment is concerned is a bit unfair, unethical. But the most of all, it's unpragmatic. It does not work. All it does is means if there's punishment involved, people never admit to their crimes, they never admit there's a problem. Under the surface, it creates more crimes. Honesty will only come when there's no punishment. When there is this understanding that you can come and tell me anything and I will just say, "Very good. I will not criticize you. I will not put you down. I will not diminish you or demean you. So you feel you can come and tell me anything and you'll never be excommunicated from this Buddhist society ever." Isn't that a wonderful sense of freedom? You have someone you can open out to. And in that opening out, the acknowledgement, there's all sorts of opportunities for rehabilitation, solving the problems for growth. How many of you have got these secrets inside which you don't want to tell others? Why? Because you're afraid if you tell somebody, they will demean you. You feel embarrassed. You feel ashamed. That's why there's no truth. But when there's no punishment, you can open up, tell someone else, and my goodness, you feel so free. That's one of the good things about the Catholic Church when they have these confessionals. It reminds me, I read this story of this priest was in, you know, his side of the confessional in the church, and this drunk came in and sat in the confessional next to him. He sat there quietly. And after a few minutes, the priest, coughed. And the drunk was still quiet. And so the priest knocked so he could start the confessional. And the drunk said, "You don't need to cough and knock. There's no toilet paper in this cubicle either." Okay, get it? It's a joke. He's a drunk. And that's a new joke. Thankfully, somebody gave me for my 60th birthday a new joke book. And so you'll be exposed to a few of those over the coming weeks. So on this talk to this evening, I've gone on about... supposed to start with human rights, but I talked about the container and the contents. Please remember the contents are more important than any container, especially with religions. And this is important in human rights, to understand religious freedom. Religious freedom from all these containers and worshipping containers. Let's just keep with the contents, the kindness and love, what underlines these religions, what actually binds us together, you know, which gives us a sense that we can be at peace and happy together. And lastly, I was talking about the idea of justice, which was part of this human rights talk. Justice, please, does not mean punishment. You've done bad things in the past. I've done stupid things in the past, but I never want to kill myself or hurt myself or punish myself for anything which I've done. I want to learn from it. So I'm really honest. If I've done something wrong, I let people know. I open up, and my fellow monks, you can tell them anything. They say, "Oh yeah, that's a terrible thing you did, but very good. Now what can we do about that? So we'd never do it again." There's a lovely feeling of openness. You can actually tell someone your darkest secrets, and they won't be used as blackmail later on. They won't be used against you. They'll be understood, accepted. And there's this great sense of relief, and also the great sense of being able to go forward in the future. So you never need to make that mistake again. That is where there's real so-called justice, solving the problems and making a better world. Not a world of fear of letting people know what one has done and punishing, but fear of openness, respect, just like that burglar was given by that monk, the only person who was ever kind and generous to him, even though he was stealing and doing something wrong. The monk could forgive the burglar. Can't you forgive your partner? Your friend, yourself. That's what we really want. That's what that burglar was given by the monk. That's why he came, to steal the secret. And this evening, you have that secret. Thank you for listening. Last week I forgot, because it was the first week back, any questions or comments or complaints? It's really important at the end of a talk, if anyone has a question to ask, put your hand up and I'll try and answer it. Going, gone. Good, okay. So now we can pay respects to Bodhidharma Sangha, and then we can go back. Sompong, Tilanga, Chön Kama.
Alaham Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadim Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.